This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. And for the next couple of times that I read, I would like to consider the matter of plants and politics. And I will be using some essays by Jamaica Kincaid, a sassy, opinionated woman who speaks her mind without any hesitation. She grew up in Antigua and somehow got to the States and was discovered by the New Yorker magazine, where she became one of the talk reporters. And her voice was strong and original. And so a lot of her talk pieces have been collected. This one from The New Yorker is called Alien Soil. Whatever it is in the character of the English people that leads them to obsessively order and shape their landscape to such a degree that it looks like a painting, tamed, framed, captured, kind, decent, good, pretty, while a painting never looks like the English landscape unless it's a bad painting, the quality of the character is blissfully lacking in the Antiguan people. When the English were a presence in Antigua, they first came to the island as slave owners when a man named Thomas Warner established a settlement there in 1632. The places where they lived were surrounded by severely trimmed hedges of plumbago, topiaries of willow, frangipani, hibiscus. Their grass was green. Odd, because water was scarce. The proper word for the climate is not sunny, but drought-ridden. And they kept trellises covered with roses and beds of marigolds and cannas and chrysanthemums. Ordinary Antiguans, and by ordinary Antiguan I mean the Antiguan people who are descended from African slaves brought to this island by Europeans, this turns out to be a not uncommon way to become ordinary. When these people, the Antiguans, lived under the influence of the other people, the English, there was naturally an attempt among some of them to imitate their rulers in this particular way, by rearranging the landscape, and they did it without question. Then the English left, and most of their landscaping influence went with them, and then the Americans came, but the Americans, I am one now, are not interested in influencing people directly. We instinctively understand the childish principle of monkey see, monkey do. Thomas Jefferson, a great American gardener and our country's third president who owned slaves and strongly supported the idea of an expanded American border, which meant the extinction of the people who already lived on the land to be taken, while at the same time he was passionately devoted to ideas about freedom. What did the botanical life of Antigua consist of at the time of another famous adventurer, Christopher Columbus, when he first saw it? To see a garden in Antigua now will not supply a clue. I made a visit to Antigua this spring, and most of the plants I saw there came from somewhere else. The bougainvillea is native to tropical South America. The plumbago is from Southern Africa. The croton from Asia. The hibiscus from East Africa, and so on. What herb of beauty grew in this place then? What tree? And did the people who lived there grow anything beautiful for its own sake? I do not know. I can only make a straightforward deduction. The frangipani, the mahogany tree, and the cedar tree are all native to the West Indies, so these trees are probably indigenous. And some of the botany of Antigua can be learned from medicinal folklore. And then she tells about the chinaberry tree that her mother used to treat thrush in her children and that the children played with. And yet, the people of Antigua have a relationship to agriculture that does not please them at all. Their very arrival on this island had to do with forces of agriculture. When we, were brought to this island from Africa a few hundred years ago, it was not for pottery-making skills or way with the loom. It was for the free labor they could provide in the fields. An African woman born in Bermuda and spent part of her life as a slave in Antigua, and Henry Louis Gates writes of this, "My master and mistress went on one occasion to the country of Date Hill for a change of air and carried me with them to take charge of the children and do the work of the house. While I was in the country, I saw the field Negroes working in Antigua. They worked very hard and were fed but scantily. They are called out to work before daybreak and come home after dark, and then each has to heave his bundle of grass for the cattle in the pen. Then on Sunday morning, each slave has to go out and gather a large bundle of grass, and when they bring it home, they have to sit at the manager's door and wait till he come out. Often they have to wait there till past 11 o'clock without any breakfast. After that, they have yams or potatoes and hasten to market to buy salt fish or pork, which is a great treat for them. Perhaps it makes sense that a group of people with such wretched historical relationship to growing things would need to describe their current relationship as dignified and masterly, and would not find it poetic or pleasurable. In a book I am looking at, I find statements like this: the concept of a private garden planted purely for aesthetic purposes was generally alien to tropical countries, and there was no such tradition of horticulture among the inhabitants of hot weather places. And here a few questions occur to me. What if people living in the tropics, the ones whose history isn't tied up with and contaminated by slavery and indenturedness, are contented with their surroundings and happy to observe an invisible hand at work, and from time to time to laugh at some of the ugly choices it makes? When I was looking at a book of tropical gardens, I realized that the flowers and trees so familiar to me from my childhood do not now have a hold on me. I do not long to plant and be surrounded by bougainvillea. I do not like tropical hibiscus, so beautiful when tended, so ugly when left to itself, which makes everything around it look rusty and shabby, is not a plant I like at all. I returned from my visit to Antigua, the place where I was born, to a small village in Vermont, the place where I now choose to live. Spring had arrived. The tulips I had planted last autumn were in bloom, and I liked to sit and caress their petals, which felt disgustingly delicious, like scraps of pot de soie. The dizzy-making yellow of dandelions and cowslips that were in the fields and the riverbanks and marshes, I like these things. I do not like daffodils, but that's the legacy of the English. I was forced to memorize a poem by William Wordsworth when I was a child. And I'll just read you a little bit of this poem, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats high o'er the vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd of a host of golden daffodils beside a lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. For oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. I think that Jamaica Kincaid is really closer to this sentiment than she realizes, because a lot of her gardening takes place in her mind. In another essay, she says, "The reason I do not like daffodils is not at all aesthetic, but much more serious than that, having been forced to memorize a poem about daffodils when none were to be found naturally in the places where I grew up." She says in another essay, she was trying to make flower beds, and they were turning out to be odd shapes, odd in relation to the way flower beds usually look in a garden. I could see that they were odd, and I could see that they didn't look like the flower beds in gardens I admired, the gardens of my friends, the gardens portrayed in my books on gardening, but I couldn't help that. I wanted a garden that looked something like what I had in my mind's eye. But exactly what that might be, I did not know, and even now I don't know. And this must be why a garden for me is so bound up with words about the garden, with the words themselves. In a proper garden, they become much more difficult to explain to other gardeners who had more experience of a garden than I, and more of an established aesthetic of garden than I. "What is this?" I had been asked. "What are you trying to do here?" I have been asked, and sometimes I would reply by saying, I really don't know," or sometimes I would reply with absolute silence. When it dawned on me that the garden I was making, and am still making, and will always be making, resembled a map of the Caribbean and the sea that surrounds it, I did not tell this to the gardeners who asked me to explain the thing I was doing or explain what I was trying to do. I only marveled at the way the garden for me is an exercise in memory, a way of remembering my own immediate past, a way of getting past to a past that is my own, the Caribbean Sea, and the past that is indirectly related to me, I think that this is the theme of what Nancy and I are doing, that words and gardens and gardeners and writers are in some interesting way connected. So we'll explore more of these ideas another time. Thank you. I'm so pleased to be able to do this, because it must be apparent that the subtext to everything that I do is that I love literature and I love gardens. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.